Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is the Armchair Cricket Podcast.
Hello all. Welcome to another episode of Armchair Cricket Podcast, a podcast focusing on test cricket by armchair critics of the game. I'm your host, Arjit. In today's episode, we have a very special guest, a first-time guest, but somebody who's very knowledgeable and who's been both writing about cricket as well as covering cricket in terms of commentary and other ways. So, hello Rahul, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Ajit, and thank you so much for the opportunity.
I also use this to make some friends sometimes, but also reach out to people who follow cricket in different parts of the world. So let's start there. So you are in the corner of the world, if the world were to have a corner, New Zealand. How is New Zealand treating you?
Absolutely. Like we often say in New Zealand that our distance from the rest of the world is our boon. But then when it comes to watching cricket that's played in the rest of the world, it sometimes turns out to be a curse because of the time difference. Mm-hmm. But now, New Zealand's been treating me really well. Been here for the last 12 years, played cricket here, umpired cricket here, started writing about cricket, got opportunities to do some commentary, and building a nice little alternative career for myself, doing what I absolutely love doing. So it's great.
This is fantastic to hear. So in that way, I think you're my role model. You sort of taken the steps that I would one day want to take as well. In either case, you told me you were able to do a commentary gig on or cover the T20 World Cup last year. Can you take us through the experiences, how that was?
Yeah, it came about because I work full-time as a banker. And I got a 2-year stint in the Cook Islands that I through work, and mm-hmm. I went there and I lived there. Mm-hmm. When I was there, I got an opportunity to write for the local newspaper, which is called the Cook Island News. And I started writing articles for them, cricket related stuff. Mm-hmm. And then through that, an opportunity came up of covering the T20 World Cup in Australia. So I had to actually fundraise for that trip of mine. So because as you know, going to Australia to cover a World Cup is quite expensive. So mm-hmm. Especially because you know you've got to fly everywhere and I had to stay in hotels, etc. So yeah, I actually went to the market, found a sponsor. The paper was generous enough to help me by giving them some free advertising space for the amount of money that they donated towards my trip. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it kind of worked out. I also got a gig doing some radio work for a radio station in Auckland in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. It's called Radio Tarana. So I did a bit of work for them. So they paid a little bit of money for that. And that's how that whole trip came together. So I went to Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide and Brisbane and covered a whole lot of New Zealand Australia games because that essentially was my reader base. I did a couple of India games as well.
Nice.
So I did the India Bangladesh game in the World T20 World Cup. So I was in Adelaide when that happened, the famous one which rain interrupted and India turned that game around.
Right.
And that lovely direct hit by KL Rahul from the deep to get, I think it was Litton Das who got run out. Then that turned the game in India's favor. So I was there at the ground. I was also at the ground to watch. I was also at the ground to watch India get beaten in that semi-final by England. So, yeah, it was it's been an experience of a lifetime, to be honest. I've never done anything like that in my life. And it was fantastic to sit in the media box and, you know, chat to people that you've read about, chat to people that you've idolized right throughout your career. And it's a surreal experience. It's also quite, I don't know, you know, when you're a cricket fan and you tend to have idols and you tend to look at cricketers and with starry eyes, but when you're in a media box and cricketers are roaming around you left, right and center, that whole starry-eyedness reduces a lot because you just tend to look at them like your colleagues, like you're in the lift somewhere and you know, Ravi Shastri could be next to you, and you are in the line grabbing some food to eat, and Michael Clarke is behind you, and so yeah, it kind of and they're also really nice individuals because they make you feel very welcome, and even the rest of the colleagues that were around me, a lot of them actually didn't know where the Cook Islands was, so. On my name tag, when it said Rahul Patil Cook Island News, they used to look at it and say, Cook Islands? Is that near the Caribbean? And
might as well be. It's far away from anything else, right? So, okay.
Yeah, it is. It is in the middle of nowhere. So, it used to create a conversation starter. And so, it was a great experience and a life-changing one. Sometimes, you know, when you I'm not sure whether this is the right thing for me to do in life. And you get an opportunity like that. And I was there for about 5 weeks covering that whole World Cup.
Wow.
And at the end of 5 weeks, I didn't feel tired at all. You know, and normally if you are at work and you're working for five continuous weeks, you tend to get a bit of fatigue and you're like, I want to do something else or something like that. But this didn't feel like that. And that kind of trip kind of sealed it for me, wherein I realized, like, this is what I want to do. And I need to work harder to make this into a full-time career because it doesn't feel like a job at all.
Right. I mean, that's when you know, that's the right thing for you. When you love your job, it's not a job, right?
Exactly. I mean, couldn't agree with you more.
Perfect. So it's a nice story. It's a very... I must say, an inspiring story to go on, find some money for yourself, get some funding so that you can pursue your dream and actually follow cricket for 5 weeks as a whole World Cup unfolded. That's a fantastic, fantastic thing to do. So, well done. And I hope you, as I said, you may also get more opportunities, I hear. Are you going to India this year again to try and cover it?
Yes. So this time, as you know, I'm already writing for a New Zealand-based website called Sports Freaks. So I am in talks with quite a well-known radio broadcaster in New Zealand. And hopefully by this time next week, I should have some good news on that front.
Fantastic.
So I will be covering for that. I'm also still in talks with Radio Tarana. I did some work with them for the T20 World Cup. So they're quite keen to do some work with me again for the ODI World Cup. I'm also talking to a couple of news agencies here for the writing side of it because I've realized that gone are the days when you can just be a one-trick pony. You know, you've as a media person, you people expect you to do different things like do some radio analysis, do some Facebook videos, do some writing. So there's a whole lot of avenues in media, and I'm trying to kind of dip my feet into all of them. One thing I've realized is never say no to anything. If someone says, hey, can you do this? Just say yes and learn on the job. because
nice.
Yeah, because you tend to, nobody is born with skills that are perfect. You know, you've got to learn. And like when I started writing, I had no experience writing, but I see my first article and I see my articles now, and I myself can see that there's been a huge change in the way I write and the way I think about the game and the way I present what my thoughts are. So it's just a matter of saying, yep, I can do it, and then finding ways and means to do things better. So yeah, I will be definitely going to India. It's just that thankfully the schedule is finally out and now, well, I can get booking. So
let's start right there. You know, the schedule came out only this week. It's ridiculously late, considering, you know, other tournaments released the schedule a year ahead of time to allow fans to plan their travel and so on. Also professionals, right, like yourself. So in this case, how much of a hassle is it now that you start looking for bookings, flights, and so on? India's a big country.
I think it's a massive, massive hassle. I mean, we all know that if you book in advance, you tend to save a lot more money than when you book closer to the time. And as a freelance journalist at the moment, I know what sort of budget constraints there are that you need to follow and adhere to. So it would be great if things could be finalized in advance. So that's one side of it. I think the other side of it is, it also depends on which team you're following. So I'm following the Black Caps around for the World Cup. From that point of view, and I had a quick look at the venues and the hotels and everything, and nothing's changed. But a lot of my friends who are following India around have already started complaining that the moment the draw got released yesterday and finalized, hotel prices have gone up in those cities. You know, flights have been completely booked. So those kind of logistical issues definitely come with big teams like India, and the same with Pakistan. Bangladesh has a massive following, and they've got a massive media contingent also that follows that team around. So teams like that will find it really difficult to get. But I think, thankfully, as far as the Black Caps are concerned, they, as always, they always go under the radar. And somehow make it to the semifinals of every world tournament that they play in. So, yeah, I think we'll be all right. But it's not the best timing from the ICC or BCCI for that matter.
So, I mean, let's start right there again. So, will Kane Williamson make the tournament, you think, from New Zealand perspective?
Funny you should ask that, because just yesterday there was a video that was released of him training in the gym, and he had a bit of a media interaction saying he's giving himself the best chance. He's sticking to his plans and things are working out really well. I think from what I gather, it's unlikely that he'll be available for game one, but there could be a chance that he might be available, say, for the second half or the last quarter of the tournament. Towards the business end of the tournament, as we call it. But then, if he does play, he'll go in really raw. He won't have any match practice when he goes in. But then, he is Kane Williamson. You know, he is the best batsman to come out of New Zealand for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. So, it'll really be up to himself, I think, and the team management, whether they want to take that risk. My gut feel is that he will travel with the team, if not as a player, as a mentor. And I think he will be around, and they will closely monitor his match fitness. And if there is a chance of playing him you don't know, in a long tournament, you know, somebody else gets injured, and if Williamson is 80-90% fit and good to go, you never know what might happen. So, yeah, he could be a late inclusion in that side. That's what I feel.
All right. I mean, I don't want to go into the New Zealand side statistics or side composition set. It's early enough. But just from the fixtures, if you were to look, New Zealand opened the tournament playing against England. Bit of irony there, just to remind what happened in the last such a final game. Right? And then...
Absolutely.
Somebody had a sense of humor.
Yeah. No, but that's what they normally do. Don't the last two finals always open the World Cup the next time around?
Yes. Yeah. I know, yeah. I know. But yeah. I mean, it's usually also just a way for a continuity, you know, of the story, so to say. But if you are a New Zealand cricketer who actually played in that game, you might have a different recollection of it. So, and so on. And then they play the qualifier one, right? And then they play Bangladesh. So, okay, it sort of sets them up. And then they play Afghanistan. I'm just looking at it. So from venues perspective and other things, anything that jumps out for you, I mean, looking at the whole fixtures might be a bit much, but at least if you are following a New Zealand team, anything particularly jump out at you when you look at the itinerary of New Zealand?
Yeah, I think that's a great draw for them, to be honest. They're only playing in 6 venues, unlike India, right, who's playing in 9 out of the 10. Which means they're not traveling as much as the other teams are. So they've got 2 games in Bangalore, they've got 2 games in Chennai, and they've got 2 games in Dharamsala. So I think from a continuity point of view, playing at the same ground twice is always good. And they'll enjoy the conditions up in the north of the country. I think if you take out Chennai, they've got a game in Pune as well. So
Pune, yeah.
Yeah, so they'll enjoy playing on those wickets. You know, they're true wickets, they're hard wickets. And for white ball cricket, I'm sure the pitches will be full of runs and quick pitches. So, I think New Zealand's actually got a very decent draw. They've not had the best of luck leading up. Apart from Williams, and Michael Bracewell has also been ruled out.
Correct.
So they'll need all the luck they get to kind of put their best foot forward in this tournament. And getting a draw like that is something that's very suitable for them at this stage, at least.
So look, in this case, they end the league stages. They play Pakistan and they play the second qualifier. Those are the last 2 games for them in Bangalore. So playing a qualifier at the end, do you think that gives them a little bit of an advantage if there is any net run rate or other considerations?
Yeah, the funny aspect though is the qualifiers could be teams like Sri Lanka and
Zimbabwe probably.
And Zimbabwe, you know, so they're not minnows by any chance, you know, they're good teams. I think we'll be discrediting those 2 teams if we say that there's a chance that New Zealand could up their net run rate against them. I think in a long tournament like that, you've got to be careful at every stage, you know. And cricket's a funny game. When you have the chance, you have to drive home that advantage. If you have a chance of winning big, you've got to press on that accelerator and try and win big. And if you're in a position that you're going to lose a game, you just have to try to make sure you don't lose it by a massive margin. That leaves you too much to do. So I think there'll be... every team watches out for net run rates nowadays. So it is an advantage playing in Bangalore, small ground. You know, if you're chasing, you can chase anything over there. We've seen that in the IPL. So yeah, it's not a bad draw for them. It's a really good draw.
Okay. Now we just briefly touched upon the qualifiers. I think we should just quickly get into it. The World Cup qualifiers are, well, the league stages are done. So the Super Sixes have been identified. So let's start there. Any surprises in the teams that have composed the Super Six for you?
I think Ireland is a big disappointment. When I was in Australia, I saw Ireland play that T20 World Cup and they were looking really good. They had players who were putting up their hand up in different situations. Even the games that they lost, they were really unlucky to lose some of them, you know, and sometimes you need the rub of the green to go your way. And they didn't have that. They got a couple of games that got rained out in Melbourne. And I was sitting there and speaking to Balbirnie, the captain, and he was saying, I wish we had got this game because this was really crucial. And you could hear that, you know, they were feeling that they were in with a chance. And from there, to see them not even make it to the Super Six stage is quite disappointing. I think they'll be very disappointed with their own performance.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's been a massive regression for them in performance. At the same time, Scotland has found their mojo again. And, you know, the way they're playing, I think that's been a big surprise as far as that qualifier is concerned. I think we all expected Sri Lanka to do well. We all expected Zimbabwe to do well because they're playing at home. There's a chance that the mighty West Indies might not be there in the main draw of a World Cup. Since 1975, and I think a lot of people have still not got over that fact that that could actually happen, and it's got a good chance of happening. But just another low amongst all the lows of West Indies cricket that we've come to know over the years. It's a sad day for West Indies cricket.
Absolutely. See, in this Group B, you would think Ireland would probably take the place of Oman if you were to ask me before the tournament started, right? They would go to the Super Sixes. But they missed that.
Yeah. And they will be very disappointed, as I said. You know, I know how passionate all the players playing for Ireland are. I know the kind of hard work they put in. I know how they are playing in professional leagues all around the world. And so it will be a huge disappointment for them not making that Super Six stage. On the other end, Netherlands, you know, your home country. What a surprise. And I don't know if you know, but there's a Wellington connection to that country.
Yes.
As well, with Logan Van Wijk.
He's been on this podcast.
And, has he?
Yes. And I'm very happy that a friend of the podcast did something unbelievable in those last couple of minutes of that game.
Yeah, so I've known Logan for a while now because, again, local boy, plays for the Wellington Firebirds. Does a lot of good things when he's playing club cricket and when he's playing first-class cricket. But just he absolutely played out of his skin. And I don't know if you read that tweet by Joy Bhattacharya the other day, but about how Logan's grandfather, who used to live in the West Indies and played Test cricket for West Indies, he played five Test matches for the West Indies against Australia, then immigrated from the West Indies to New Zealand, played three Test matches for New Zealand against the West Indies. So he played against his own ex-team.
Yes, this is something he had spoken of. Very interesting. He has a good pedigree.
Yes, absolutely. And you can't script these things. This is just phenomenal. And now that same Logan Van Wijk, all these years later, ends up playing for the Netherlands and scores a match, which puts in a match-winning performance against his grandfather's old team, which is the West Indies. You know, it's just unbelievable. I mean, this is like a movie. So
absolutely. I mean, it's you're right. You couldn't script it even if you wanted to. It's so fantastic. I was actually seriously working, and then you know, the game got closer and closer. You probably didn't think they would have a chance. You thought they would fight really hard, lose by 20 runs in the end or whatever, right? But then the way Teja Nidamanuru played, the 100 he scored, it was the fastest 100 by a Netherlander, of course, in ODIs. And that guy had something to prove. He's come really good in this tournament, also made a 50. And the captain, he scored three consecutive half centuries, most of them at strike rate of above 110 or something. And they both added like 143 of 90 balls. So that's where the game was set up. And then they both got out in like very short interval. And that's when, you know, you again lost hope. I almost stopped following at that point in time, right? I thought, okay, we'll take a look at what happens in the last 2 hours. So, in fact, I sat down a couple of my Dutch colleagues, who one of them who just knows the game barely, the other is an Indian expat as well. So he and me, we were following Netherlands and we were hoping they'll get across. Man, there was a tactical error there to have a spinner bowl the 49th over chase, right? The game started turning there. You know, even today, scoring 30 in a limited overs international in the last 2 hours is not a joke. But Logan Van Beek made that happen. In fact, he bought it to 29 of 11. And needing only one of the last ball, he was really unlucky to be out. That was a great catch by Holder. And maybe you could always say Logan could have done more. But come on, he brought them there. And I thought that the tactical mistake of bowling a spinner in the 49th over, because he bowled out all his other important bowlers before that point in time, hoping to finish the game off. It didn't. And Logan Van Beek pounced. And I think that hitting set him up in such a way that he was given the go in the super over. Will anybody eclipse this 30 runs in the super over, do you ever think?
I don't think so. I mean, it's a phenomenal performance. And then to come back and pick up two wickets in that with the ball,
absolutely,
I don't think anybody's put in a better performance in a super over.
Exactly.
Just to add to everything that you said, I think that's the gamble that captains sometimes take, as you rightly said, that he was hoping that he wouldn't have to use that over by the spinner, and he thought that the game would be out of contention by then, and he took that gamble, and it didn't pay off. I think the other thing that left a lot of people mystified was that Hope came out in the super over and not Nicholas Puran.
That was strange.
Yeah, that to me, like, and Puran has got a hundred and a couple of hundreds in this tournament already. So he's in form, and I just couldn't understand. I couldn't believe my eyes when I saw Shai Hope coming out. And I was like, is this right? And I don't think it was the best day for the West Indies, strategically or tactically, as you said. So, yeah, they missed a lot of tricks that day. Yeah.
Look, he had overs from Kimo Paul and Romario Shepherd. If you wanted to call upon one of the faster men, neither of them were successful that day, by the way. They went for a lot of runs.
Yeah.
But I think Romario Shepherd sort of also specializes bowling at the death. I mean, I would have trusted him with the ball instead of Chase. I mean, that over really broke the chase. I mean, Chase broke the chase, so to say. Because at even 10 runs more, a couple of big hits less, you know, you could have thought, again, Netherlands would lose whatever, much more narrower than you thought. But, well, the rest, as they say, is history. But then what have West Indies left themselves to do? They made the super over, but as a super six, but they have no points to carry over, right? They have lost to both the other teams that are coming, Zimbabwe and Netherlands.
Yeah, so, and they've left their fate in other people's hands now. So it's going to be an uphill task from here. And I mean, it'll be a sad day if they don't make it. But I think the writing's on the wall as far as they're. Yeah,
I mean, the way things are set up, you don't see Sri Lanka or Zimbabwe probably really blundering that much. Zimbabwe will have to lose all their games, right? I mean, you really can't see them do that. And they also have games against Oman, right? So, it's and that the defeat against Zimbabwe was already the killer for me, if you ask, right?
Yes.
That was not that big a chase. It was less than 300. And West Indian batting was going good in the tournament, right? Like what you already pointed out. Puran scored 200s. Their top order has been in decent nick. Their lower and middle order is really sort of a little bit conspicuous by its absence. Jason Holder onwards. That's where it probably cost them the game. Hope played well, and of course, Chase also had played well in that game. So now you see, now it's come down to haunt them. Probably if they had finished out the Zimbabwe Chase better, even this upset could have been ridden out. But now it's compounding that sort of mistake where you couldn't win against Zimbabwe. Now this sudden, out of nowhere comes this upset, and you are now really out of the tournament almost. On the other hand, if you were to look at the other group, Sri Lanka have been clinical. Absolutely. Their bowlers, I think Hasaranga has taken 3 back-to-back 5-fours.
Yes.
Right?
And I read a stat somewhere that he's matched the feat of the great Waqar Yunus now. In that,
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what I was about to bring that up. So, it's no mean a feat to actually do this. I think he's too good a spinner for certain teams. I mean, even today with his googly. The only thing I noticed was in one of those games, it was 5 for 79 or something. In a low chase, in a chase where they restricted the opposition under 200, he gave away 79 runs. That was a bit weird. But nonetheless, it's worth it if you can take 5 wickets, right? The game, you're always going to win the game. What are statistics if you can't win the game at the end of the day? So, well done to them. And their top order is suddenly with Sadhira Samarvikrama somewhat looking more mature in this return to Sri Lankan team. I think they're looking more composed as a team. And again, their fast bowlers are not really, really great yet. But you would expect Kasun, Rajita, Kumara, they'll somehow come good. And the spinners will do enough to make sure, you know, Sri Lanka will win one or two games and that's it. They're going to go to the final. So it's, I really expect Zimbabwe-Sri Lanka final. Any chance you think otherwise?
No, at this stage, it looks like a Zimbabwe-Sri Lanka final. So unless, of course, we get you know, as we said, if one of them drops a game and some of the other teams pick up ones here and there, then we could. But at this stage, at least, it doesn't look like. It looks like a straight shootout between Sri Lanka and Zimbabwe for that top spot. I think Zimbabwe, because they're playing at home, will definitely, and Sri Lanka is looking in ominous form at the moment in that tournament, at least. I also like Dimuth Karunaratne at the top.
Yes.
I think he's, for a long time, they've not had an experienced batter who plays proper cricketing shots at the top. And I think he just is the calming influence. He is their test captain. So he's kind of got that stature in that team also. So I think he's a good addition at the top. Reminds me a bit. They used to have a guy called Upul Taranga who used to open for them back in the day. Very good left-hander, used to be very technically correct and used to play some gorgeous looking shots through the offside especially. And Karunaratne just fits into that mold. And he is a perfect long format player. I think he's the kind of player that can get you 120 ball 100 while the others can bat around him. And in 50-over cricket, I think there's still a place for players like that. So, yeah, good on them for kind of going back to him and getting some experience in the side. So, yeah.
I mean, I think he sort of made another go at trying to secure a place for himself at the top of the order, Karunaratne, for the World Cup, and he's succeeded, right?
Yeah.
I think you can't see a Sri Lankan team without him, ODIs at least, for this year anymore. So, he's done enough there. So, that's well done him. You're also bringing up a valid point. And for West Indies, right? So, yesterday, I think Sammy said in a press conference that, you know, this is an accurate reflection of where West Indies cricket is. They always managed to pull their weight when it came to tournaments. They at least used to qualify or by default be there, right? But they also won a couple of T20 tournaments under Sammy, the World Cups. So, this is a big blow. Their longer format is on the way down and so on. And they are being less and less, let's say, bright when it comes to T20 or ODI World Cups. But this one, missing this altogether, I really hope this is the wake-up call that turns the West Indian cricket ship around.
True. And but there have been a few of these calls in the past for them, you know. They've had some real lows. And we think, okay, this could be the catalyst and this could be the catalyst and this could be the catalyst. And there have been a number of those. I mean, I remember West Indies winning an under-19 World Cup not so long back, which was the T20 format. In the 50-over under-19 World Cup, there was, I think, might have been the one in Bangladesh that they won. But again, you know, you thought, okay, at least they've got some youngsters that are going to come through and do something, you know. But somehow, that whole structure's not producing national team results. I mean, they're great individuals who play around the world and play some fantastic cricket around the world. But when they come together as a team to play under one flag, it's not working. And I don't know West Indies cricket well enough. All I know is that they are losing a lot of youngsters who go to America and are playing basketball. And cricket's not the number one preferred game in the West Indies anymore. So that is one. The second thing I know is that the board has been dysfunctional for a long time now, and they've had heaps of issues in that sense. So yeah, they've got some major structural and fundamental issues there, which are affecting, and it's their on-field performances. So yeah, I don't know what the answer is and how they're going to come out of that. But yeah, it's a sad day, nevertheless.
But yeah, I mean, they have also the, let's say, the wisdom that is required in those islands, the former players and administrators. The only problem is, are the right ones doing the right jobs? This is a question. But also, I think eventually it falls down to the captain of the West Indies team, right? It's always the focal point of the West Indies team has been a strong captain, be it Clive Lloyd, Rich Richardson, up to a point, even, Viv Richards. But then once these great captains went away, the team sort of fallen on the wayside. Sammy may have done his bit a little bit for there and, you know, here and there, but they have not had this stable influence of a captain who's ruthless enough to drive himself and drive the players. Because as far as talent goes, there's not a lot of question there. So it's, as you say, it's about pulling together as a team and performing when required, sort of not letting the team down. So you also have a couple of wasted talents. Some people who walked away from the setup. Shimron Hetmeyer, I think, looks like he's on the outs now. People like Kimo Paul, who are also part of that under-19 winning World Cup, they have not really transformed their promise to, you know, results at the top level. So there are some structural issues as well as, you know, individual temperament issues. So a lot to discuss there, but I hope they really find a way. This is for the good of world cricket itself. Now, if you were to have a quick review of the women's Ashes test, any chance you had a, you know, maybe even saw some of these days live potentially? I know the time difference makes it tough.
Yeah, I mean, I did. The thing is, these games start at 10 o'clock New Zealand time at night. And as I mentioned, I have a full-time job that I work at from 8 o'clock in the morning. So it does make it tough. But I did manage. I normally used to catch the first session on most days. And then I try and catch some of the last session if I woke up a bit early. I've long maintained that, you know, the beauty of this Australian women's cricket team is that there is just so much talent there, and they are light years ahead of some of the competition that they have in world cricket at the moment. A few years back, there was a World Cup which was hosted by New Zealand, a women's World Cup, and it was the difference between the Australian women's cricket team and the rest of the world is massive. They were beating good teams, and not just beating them, they were literally demoralizing them with their performances. And they are just a class apart. I mean, this is a team that has won against a very strong England side without their normal captain being there, you know.
Right. So Meg Lanning, she pulled up.
Meg Lanning not being there. And they have managed to put in a performance like this. And someone or the other always puts their hand up, no matter what the match situation is, no matter what the game situation is. In white ball cricket, you've superstar after superstar. You know, Beth Mooney is a superstar. Alyssa Healy is a superstar. Elise Perry is a superstar. Meg Lanning, as we said, is a superstar. And now suddenly you get Annabel Sutherland, who just stands up and puts her hand up and says, okay, I'll do it for the team this time, and just takes the responsibility and does it. She also, like Logan Manvey, comes from a very rich pedigree of cricketers. Her brother is Will Sutherland, who's played under-19 World Cup cricket for Australia and plays in the Big Bash League currently. She's also the daughter of James Sutherland, who used to be the CEO of Cricket Australia and a good ex-cricketer himself. So, so she's got, and that 100, that timely 100 that she got in the first innings was absolutely brilliant. From England's point of view, I think Sophie Eccleston, you know, always there and thereabouts. I've got a lot of time for her because whenever I watched England play, I always look at her figures because she is so economical. And she's that typical left-arm spinner who, you know, bowls a fantastic line and a fantastic length and just does enough with the ball. And and she's so hard to score off, especially, I think, the games against India. She's just literally blocks one end up with all of that.
Absolutely.
And it's no surprise that she's picked up 5 wickets in both innings. A few days back, I saw a video of Sophie. She was practicing with the England men's team, and she was actually bowling to Ben Stokes in the nets. And even Stokes, he couldn't do anything with her. All he could do was either defend her off the front foot or go back and try and tap her for a single. But every time Stokes tried to give her the charge, she was just pulling a length back just that much so that he couldn't go through with the shot. It was just about a minute's worth of footage, but it told you so much about Sophie Eccleston and how brilliant she is.
Absolutely. I mean, pound for pound, is she the best left-arm spinner in the world today? The answer is potentially yes.
Potentially, I mean, right? Yes. Yeah. I mean, they'll only, I don't know, on a turning track, maybe Ravi Jadeja comes close to her. Or, I don't know.
Jack Leach himself might not be bad, right?
But she's really good. I mean, that control that she has. And the other one is Jess Jonasson. You know, she is also equally good. But there's just something about Sophie. You know, I think the action is a bit more classical. That kind of tilts it in her favor.
Absolutely. When it comes to the result, you see they've been doing well. England, I think they blinked in the last two sessions.
Yeah.
And the test was last. I mean, you know you have to bat out four sessions because it's a high likelihood you'll probably chase this down. The total was not too far beyond their ken. I mean, they'll also regret getting, you know, letting Australia get away from 6 for 238 when Perry fell, right? To 473. So they ended up conceding a 10-run lead when you could expect, if they did the same thing they did in the second inning, they should have like a 50-60-run lead. So that was, first of all, very decisive. But then, really, the credit does go to Australia for, you know, they keep fighting. They just believed they could get away with it and they will get there. And they did.
Yeah, I just think that chasing in the fourth innings, whether it's a four-day test or a five-day test or whatever, is always difficult. And that pressure of the last innings, a wearing pitch, is always going to play its part no matter where you're playing. There's a reason why scores don't get chased down very often in the fourth innings. And you're never going to chase them down when you have one bowler like picking up, you know, Ashley Gardner picking up
eight wickets
in an innings. You know, it's a performance of a lifetime from her. So it was an uphill task. And I know where, what you're trying to say, you know, that it was within their grasp and all of that. But just fourth innings chases are never easy, you know. Even if you're chasing 150 in the fourth innings, things can turn to custard. It's just the nature of the game, the pressure, the match situation, and a wearing pitch. It's a chemistry made in heaven, which is against the batting side. So,
this case, yes.
Yeah, and they've Australians never let go. You know, they are fighters. They will fight until the last wicket falls, and they will fight until the last run is scored. So I'm sure going into that last innings, they would have said, we are well ahead in this game. Actually, we should be the one calling the shots. And because when you've got to chase that amount of score in the last innings, I'd always back the bowling side to win. So
right.
Yeah.
Anything about 250, you are mostly in safe territory, right? You just expect the conditions and the fatigue and other things to kick in.
Yeah.
And Australia, both women's as well as men, they're playing the more traditional format, the more traditional approach where you wear the opposition out. The Australian men's team showed it very adequately in the first test. So did the women. Now, speaking of the counterparts, the men's Ashes that's currently going on. So England have won the toss and will bowl first in the Lord's test. So, it's just a few minutes away from start. And, well, one fantastic stat, Nathan Lyon is playing his 100th consecutive test. So, it's quite something.
Yeah.
But are you surprised?
Not at all. I mean, he's an absolute legend. He's sitting on 495 test wickets at the moment. And I'm backing him to get number 500 in this test, maybe in the second innings. Look, what a story again, you know, from someone who was a groundsman to becoming one of Australia's premier spinners, took up off-spin bowling very late in his life. So he's not an off-spinner who, you know, came through the ranks and bowled through, went through the age groups and whatever. Started bowling very, very late in his life. And now look at him where he is, you know. The fact that he plays majority of his cricket on Australian pitches increases the respect you have for the man. And I had written this in one of my articles previously, is Australia never, ever go into a test match without Nathan Lyon, because they believe he is good enough to pick wickets on any surface. And that's the beauty of a spinner, that if you're a good spinner, you don't need a turning track to pick up wickets. And I think you know where I'm heading with this, because Ashwin's non-selection still hurts.
Yeah. That's the whole point. I made this point two episodes ago when we were discussing the reviewing the World Test Championship final. See, Ashwin, as well as he has done, he doesn't retain the same trust from the team management.
No.
That this guy will break the game open.
No.
He might be the world's top ranked bowler even in tests, right? So, all that apart, it's just about this trust. And more oftentimes than not, Lyon will deliver, will give you those two wickets. You're not looking for a bag full of wickets, right? When you're playing away in, let's say, unhelpful conditions. But one of those testing spells, one afternoon of an hour of really, really solid bowling where you'll give two wickets to your captain and the game breaks open. Ashwin has done it enough times, but unfortunately, again, he doesn't retain the trust of the leadership group. But were you going to say no? Were you going to say potentially that this is, I've misread this?
No. Absolutely. I wrote the same thing in my article as well. I said, when you lived in New Zealand for a while, you will realize that test cricket fans out here don't really rate Ashwin. And when you try and find out the reason, they call him a turning track bully. But then the problem is, they call him that because our own team management does not have faith in him to win them a test match in non-helpful conditions. And that is the biggest disservice that we are doing to a genius who deserves better.
Correct.
You know, you put it another way. Would we have ever dropped, if we had a batter who was the number one batter in test cricket, but had a poor record in England, would we have dropped him for the World Test Championship final? No, we wouldn't.
Yeah, absolutely.
We would still play. No.
You would back him.
Yeah.
I agree. So, but that's the thing, right?
Yeah.
Bowlers are not as, let's say, agnostic to conditions as batsmen. That's where it goes against what you're made up, your makeup itself, right? But I totally agree in this case, Shardul Thakur versus Ashwin, that debate, right? So, I'll not go there. But coming back to this one, Lyon, certified genius.
Yes.
And well, Australian squad has a couple of surprises. So let's quickly go through that, because they have dropped Boland and they have brought in Mitchell Starc.
Yeah.
So if ever was a pitch that could be like had Boland on return on it, it was probably this pitch, because it's green. It's not very different from the rest of the field itself. So England have gone with four fast bowlers, and they expect, let's say, people like Joe Root to bowl a little bit, maybe even Harry Brook, right? Because Stuart Broad, James Anderson were not going to get dropped for this one, right? No matter how bad it was in the previous test. Josh Stone has been brought in. Ollie Robinson retains his place. So probably somebody like Matthew Potts was probably the next cap of the rank, you thought. But I think Josh Stone, he did enough in that one opportunity he got against Ireland, right? So he's in the 11. And there are no other surprises for England. But Australia, I thought, with Cameron Green also in the 11 and him sort of maturing rapidly as a test match bowler, this is a bit of a gamble, but then Starc is always a gamble, right? I mean, a fit Starc can win your World Cup in like four balls or whatever, which he did in that 2015 finals. So this is possible. So you would always back him. He was also there or thereabouts in the World Test Championship final. He didn't do all that great. So do you think this might go against Australia when the results come out in 5 days' time?
Yeah, I think with Boland, he is very young to test cricket. He hasn't played a lot. And I think for the first time in his career, he was taken for more than six and over by the English batters in the last game. And I don't know how he has reacted to that. You know, sometimes it can be a bit of a setback because you're not used to be treated that way. You know, he's... test career so far has been exemplary. He just turns up and he picks up wickets. You know, that's been modus operandi for him so far. But suddenly he's been faced where people are charging him, people are scooping him, people are doing funny things to his bowling. So I don't know whether that's played a bit of a effect on him, wherein he's just started doubting his own skills. Starc's a wonderful bowler. I think on a pitch like this, if you're playing Lyon, you want Stark there because you want him to create some rough outside the off stump of the right-hander. So that also is another reason why I think Stark has and Lyon is such a good combo, because Stark helps Lyon in many ways. So that's another
creating footholds.
Yeah, creating those footmarks. And, you know, because from what pitches we've seen so far, the pitches looked a lot greener than what Edgbaston was. So it's a, I think it's a good call. I think they miss some lower order runs also from Stark. He's been in good batting form. And without him, that lower order just starts looking a bit longer. I mean, it's great that Cummins scored some runs in the last test in both innings.
Right.
But up until then, Pat Cummins' own batting form hasn't been great. So, in effect, if your batting starts stopping at number seven, then you've got issues. And as we've seen, if these test matches are going to be close, you need a bit of cushion there. And Stark offers that with the bat. So, all in all, I think it's a decent decision to get him in the 11. You don't want him sitting on the bench for too long also, because Stark's the kind of guy that, you know, he wants to be in the middle of the action. Personalities are different. And
right.
I think managing personalities is also a huge job of team management and coaches nowadays. If there are people who are going to get grumpy sitting on the bench, then you don't want that. And I think captains and team management know how long they can keep someone like Stark out of the team. So I think he's keen to make an impression, you know. So I think it's a good call. It's a good call to get him. England's. I still cannot understand how Mark Wood doesn't find a place in this side.
Interesting point.
I said this in my article. I said when you turned up at Edgbaston and you saw a pitch which was as flat as Edgbaston was, you picked three bowlers who are going to give you exactly the same. And I saw a comment today that George Dobell has made, which is also very interesting, wherein he said England are going into this test match with four right-arm seamers, who, or actually five right-arm seamers, if you include Stokes, who all bowl between 79 to 84 miles an hour. And where is the differentiation in there? You know, you got Anderson, you got Broad, you got Robinson. All three of them do the same thing. So does Ben Stokes. And now you've got Josh Tung, who's slightly quicker, but he's around at 85 miles per hour mark as well. The real difference is Mark Wood, who can bowl at 155 kilometers an hour. When you had a team at 227 for eight and you needed two wickets to win the test match, who does Nathan Lyon want to face, you know, in that situation? Would he have been comfortable facing and a Mark Wood who was going for his throat? I don't think so. So sometimes I think a lot of teams fall into this trap of picking a team for the first morning of the test match and forget that it's a long game, and I just cannot understand.
Look, just a counterpoint, right?
Yeah.
On a flatter deck, somebody like Mark Wood, he may have already been too costly before there ever was going to be a 228 for eight. On a flatter deck, people like Marnus and Smith, people who are like the bankers of that Australian batting lineup, for them, once they are set, people like Wood are, would become a, or could become a cannon fodder. See, this is the worry. So all I'm saying is, yes, a 228 for eight, you would want a Wood. But then would the same bowler have been as effective earlier on had the situation been slightly different? If Wood, if Smith or Labuschagne had gotten in and they started rolling the ship around, then probably Wood would be a liability suddenly. So, yes, hindsight can give you a different perspective. But I'm just saying there is another way of looking at it, and hindsight will teach you more. And this is unfortunate, and this is how things are.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with your point also. It's just that I think pace is pace here. You take, you know, it takes the pitch out of the equation. Because if you can hurl a ball at 155 kilometers an hour, you are basically nullifying whatever the pitch. I mean, you bowl in the block hole and, you know, you can get people out. You've just got that X factor. As you said, you know, you need someone to break open a game sometimes with a couple of wickets. And he could be, you know, Khwaja is known to have issues with the short ball. Travis Head has been known to have issues with the short ball. And who's their best exponent of the short ball in the country is Mark Wood and Jofra Archer, probably. Archer is not here. Mark Wood is here. So, I don't know. I mean, I just like to think out of the box a bit and see whether they could have approached this a bit different. And I'm surprised that Deepak Tang ahead of Mark Wood today.
Yeah, this is a relevant point. This is a relevant point. Again, if you have an Anderson and a Robinson with you, you might rather take a Wood than a Tang. But yeah, okay, never you mind. There are enough puns to be made there, so I'll wait on that for the whole 5 days of commentary. But in either case, just your prediction for, let's say, start with the second test and the series itself.
I mean, the first test has lived up to the hype, pre-series hype of the Ashes. Everyone said it's going to be a close series, and the first test was a very close affair. So I'd still go with a close result. I just think that it'll be a 3-2 series result. Don't ask me which side is going to be 3 and which side is going to be 2, though.
Ah, that's just sitting on the fence.
No, okay, I'll put... I'll tell you what. If my heart says England 3-2, my head says Australia 3-2, I've always been someone who follows my heart, so I'm going to say England 3-2.
All right. So, in the previous episodes, I've gone with a 2-2 result.
Okay.
Somewhat weather affecting a test. And enough making enough of a difference to cause a draw. But let's see if that goes on. But I'll give the second test to England. I expect England to come back hard and try and take this test. In the meantime, after an over, a streaker seems to have run on the pitch, apparently. And and so on. So, it's 4-4 loss as Australia backed. And yeah, it's going to be an interesting couple of days, at least if you're a cricket fan. So, well, the only other topic that remains actually a very heavy one. Pujara has been dropped from the Indian squad going to West Indies. It's the end of a World Test Championship cycle. Do you see this is the end of the road for Che Pujara?
I don't think it's the end of the road because knowing Pujara and knowing the kind of character he is, he'll continue to pile on the runs and, you know, knock on that door. See, picking someone else is well and good, but that someone else also has to take that opportunity with both hands and score runs. So if that person doesn't, then we've got issues. Now, the funny thing is that we've dropped a middle order batter and we picked two openers. So we picked Jaiswal and Gaikwad, who are both openers, to replace a Pujara, who's a middle order bat. We had a middle order bat who was not just knocking on the door, but was breaking the door down in Santra's car.
Yes, yes. This is the other question, right? Yeah.
But we didn't pick him because, and from what it appears, everybody's saying that it's cricket has got nothing to do with the decision making there. Yeah, no, to answer your question, no, I don't think this is the end of the road. I mean, did we all think that it would be the end of the road for Rahane? Yes, we did. You know, we didn't see how he could make his way back. But cricket teaches us all life lessons. And miraculously, he found his way back and made it count. And he's just bought himself another year in Test cricket, I think, with his performance in the World Test Championship final. In fact, he's now back as the vice captain of the Indian cricket team. So, yeah, it's not definitely not the end of the road. I mean, age is not on his side. I do agree. But Pujara will continue to do what Pujara does. He's playing the Duleep Trophy now in India. Mm-hmm. So, he'll pile on the runs. Yeah. And come the home test season after the monsoons, I think Pujara will stake a claim again. In case someone's injured, in case someone's not in form, he'll always be there and thereabouts, at least for another 12 to 18 months. I think that fire will be burning. Beyond that, it might be difficult.
All right. That's a reasonable timeline as well to look forward to. Last question was about Sarfaraz, right? So what more does he need to do, or does he need to do something less?
There's a old saying in cricket, you know, you just let your bat do the talking. And he has let his bat do the talking. But I think sometimes anyone who's known Indian cricket for a long time will know this, that sometimes you could be doing everything right, but you don't end up playing for the country. I mean, I'm old enough to know a guy called Amol Muzumdar,
Oh, yeah.
Who just piled on runs after runs and runs after runs and runs after runs and never managed to play for the country. And he was just
exactly.
unlucky, because he was born in an era when the Indian middle order had Tendulkar and Dravid and Lakshman and Ganguly in it.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, but and for no fault of his, he never played a game for India ever. From what we hear in the media, non-cricketing reasons are proving to be
indeed, yeah,
in Sarfaraz Khan's way. So I guess if that's the only thing stopping him from playing for India, then I think it's in his own hands how he makes sure that he just scores runs and does nothing else. You know, at the end of the day, we all have worked in corporate environments and we know that we have to hit our KPIs. Mm. But while doing those, if we do it in a nice way, then bonuses come our way. And that's just what sometimes you have to learn as a youngster, that just because you're scoring runs, you will not get picked. You also need to be ticking a lot of other boxes sometimes to make sure that you get picked. And it's a tough pill for someone as talented as him to swallow. But I think someone needs to put an arm around him and sit down with him. And who better than someone like an MS Dhoni or someone to, you know, put an arm around him and tell him, don't worry, you just keep scoring runs and do nothing else apart from that. And one day you will get picked. You know, I think that's all it takes.
As you say, I mean, there are enough good leaders in and around the team. Also, maybe people like Rahul Dravid may have already spoken to him. We don't know this, right? So, people who work in the NCA previously.
Yeah.
The Lakshman, the likes of those. They may have already had a chat. But yeah, I mean, also the attitude. Look, it's tough to judge these things when you're not in the environment. But
yeah.
a couple of people with a bit more spark, as they say, might not be a bad thing. Each person is an individual, and when it comes to his fitness as well, there's been quite a lot of talk and so on. So, okay, this, as I said, we don't know enough, but all we know is at least the people who are the current leaders and management, they're not comfortable, I suppose.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because Rohit Sharma is the captain of India, and Rohit Sharma plays first-class cricket for Mumbai. So, I'm sure that, you know, there's some sort of communication that's gone on because if my captain...
Right.
If the guy who plays first-class cricket for the same team that I play is the captain of the Indian cricket team, I'd send him a text and say, boss, what else do I need to do? And he would potentially send him a reply and you know, tell him what the issues are. And I hope it gets sorted. I know I've had the pleasure of meeting Rohit Sharma a couple of times at press conferences, and he's such a chilled out guy. And he's got no airs about himself or always... happy to help youngsters and have a chat and have a yarn. And even, you know, his interaction with the media is fantastic. So I'm sure that he'll send a quiet message through someone or maybe directly and let Sarfaraz know what's going on and what he needs to do.
Right. I mean, he'll figure it out. And for his sake, I hope he does it very quickly. Because sometimes, you know, by the time you've learned the other lessons off the field, your form has sort of waned and you're no longer the same power or the same force that you once were on the field. So let's hope he discovers it in time. Okay, those were all the main topics we wanted to discuss. So thank you very much for a wonderful chat. It's been a very deep and insightful one. So I'm not at all surprised given your experience. So speaking of experience, would you like to plug some of your work, current, future?
Yeah, so as I said, I write for a website called sportsfreak.co.nz. So if any listeners want to go and see any of my work, please feel free to go there and follow me. Give me a follow on Twitter as well. My handle is Rahul Patil NZ. Nice and simple. So yeah, find me on Twitter, and yeah, all my articles go up there as well. Any feedback's welcome. So yeah, those two are the places to look out for me at the moment. As and when I do work on radio and stuff like that, I will be posting links of that as well. And yeah, but Twitter is probably the best place to follow what I do. And sportsfreak.co.nz is the best website to read my current work.
Also, good luck with some anticipatory news for next week. And hope you get to go to India and cover the World Cup from New Zealand's perspective.
Thanks, Ajit.
We wish all our listeners a good day, wherever they may be listening from. And thanks once again to our guest. Bye-bye.
This is the Armchair Cricket Podcast.